The Works of President Jonathan Edwards, Volume 1, Chapter 5. From His Mission to the Indians Until His Death, Section 1. His Mission to the Indians at Stockbridge. If we regard Mr. Edwards' deep acquaintance with the Holy Scriptures and the influence of divine truth on his own heart, if we consider also his long experience in the work of the ministry, with his disposition to observe the operations of human minds and passions, and to improve such knowledge to the most profitable purposes, we may safely say that there were but few men, if any, better qualified to conduct a mission among the Indians. But, on the other hand, it may be questioned whether his recluse turn, his natural reserve, his contemplative habits, and the strong propensity of his mind closely to investigate abstractedly every difficult subject that presented itself were not unfavorable traits for such a situation, however beneficial it might be for his own improvement. Mr. Edwards was qualified to shine in some departments of the seats of learning, and was afterwards called to preside over one. But when he was delegate to instruct savage Indians, there was occasion to suspect there was not a perfect suitableness in the appointment. On this, however, different persons may form different opinions, and it is our business now to give some accounts of this appointment. The Indian mission at Stockbridge, a town in the western part of Massachusetts Bay, 50 miles from Northampton, being vacant by the death of the Reverend Mr. Sargent, the honored and reverend commissioners for Indian affairs in Boston, who have the care and direction of it, applied to Mr. Edwards as the most suitable person they could think of to be entrusted with that mission. At the same time, he was invited by the inhabitants of Stockbridge, and being advised by the council above mentioned to accept of the invitation, he repaired to Stockbridge and was introduced and fixed as a missionary to the Indians there by an ecclesiastical council called for that purpose August 8, 1751. When Mr. Edwards first engaged in the mission, there was a hopeful prospect of its being extensively serviceable under his care and influence, not only to that tribe of Indians which was settled at Stockbridge, but among the Six Nations, some of whom were coming to Stockbridge to settle, bringing their own and as many of their neighbors' children as they could get to be educated and instructed there. For this end, a house for a boarding school, which was projected by Mr. Sargent, was erected on a tract of land appropriated to that use by the Indians at Stockbridge, where the Indian children, male and female, were to be educated by being clothed and fed and instructed by proper persons in useful learning. The boys were to be taught husbandry or mechanic trades, and the girls all sorts of women's work. For the encouragement of this design, some generous subscribers were made both in England and America. The General Court of the Providence of Massachusetts Bay did much to promote the affair and provided lands for the Mohawks who should incline to come. With the generous Mr. Hollis, to encourage the scheme, ordered 24 Indian children to be educated on the same footing, wholly at his cost. Also the Society in London, for propagating the gospel among the Indians in and about New England, directed their commissioners in Boston to do something considerable towards this design. But partly by reason of some unhappy differences, they took place among those who had the chief management of this affair at Stockbridge, of which a particular account would not be proper in this place, and partly by the war breaking out between England and France, which is generally very fatal to such affairs among Indians, this hopeful prospect came to nothing. Mr. Edwards' labors were attended with no remarkable visible success while at Stockbridge, though he performed the business of his mission to the good acceptancy of the inhabitants in general, both English and Indians, and of the commissioners, who supported him honorably and confided very much in his judgment and wisdom in all matters relating to the mission. However, Stockbridge proved to Mr. Edwards a more quiet and, on many occasions, a much more comfortable situation than he was in before. And being so much in one corner of the country, his time was not so much taken up with company as it was at Northampton, though many of his friends from almost all parts of the land often made him pleasant and profitable visits, and he had not so much concern and trouble with other churches as he was obliged to have when at Northampton by being frequently sought to for advice and called to assist in ecclesiastical councils. Here, therefore, he followed his beloved study more closely and to better purpose than ever. In these 6 years, he doubtless made swifter advances in knowledge than ever before and added more to his manuscripts than in any equal space of time. And this was probably as useful a part of his life as any. For in this time he wrote the two last books that had been published by him, his treatises on the will and on original sin, of which a more particular account will be given hereafter, by which he has doubtless greatly served the Church of Christ and will be a blessing to many thousands yet unborn. Thus, after his uprightness and faithfulness have been sufficiently tried at Northampton, his divine master provided for him a quiet retreat, which was rendered the more sweet by the preceding storm, and where he had a better opportunity to pursue and finish some important work, which God had for him to do, so that when in his own judgment, as well as that of others, his usefulness seemed to be cut off, he found greater opportunities of service than ever. Section 2. His being chosen president of New Jersey College. While at Stockbridge, Mr. Edwards appears to have given full scope of his propensities and genius, stimulated by his ardent love of truth and under the control of a correct judgment. While at Northampton, his application were unavoidably numerous and scarcely compatible with a profound attention to subjects he might be dispensed to investigate, but at Stockbridge he found himself more at liberty in that respect. After having been so long in the ministry elsewhere, his pulpit preparations would require less time than before. His studies were less interrupted by company and calls. Former anxieties were now removed. The mind was drawn more closely to God from his past experience of the fickleness of men, and thereby his mind became more composed, more enlightened, and more elevated. Here he was led to investigate subjects of radical importance in morals and theology and to trace them to their first principles. And here he published his masterpiece of inquiry and close reasoning, his treatise on the will, which completely established his character as an adept in metaphysic science and a profound divine. The celebrity he attained by this work, and very deservedly obtained, had, doubtless, no small influence on the trustees of New Jersey College, among other considerations, in looking to Mr. Edwards to become the president on the death of Mr. Burr, his son-in-law. The Reverend Aaron Burr, president of New Jersey College, died on the 24th of September, 1757, and at the next meeting of the trustees, Mr. Edwards was chosen as successor, the news of which was quite unexpected and not a little surprising to him. He looked on himself in many respects so unqualified for that business that he wondered that gentlemen of so good judgment and so well acquainted with him, as he knew some of the trustees were, should think of him for that place. He had many objections in his own mind against undertaking the business, both from his unfitness and his particular circumstances, yet could not certainly determine that it was not his duty to accept it. The following extract of a letter, which he wrote to the trustees, will give the reader a view of his sentiments and exercises on this occasion, as well as the great designs he was deeply engaged in and zealously prosecuting. Stockbridge, 19th October, 1757. Reverend and Honorable Gentlemen, I was not a little surprised on receiving the unexpected notice of your having made choice of me to succeed the late President Burr as the head of Nassau Hall. I am much in doubt whether I am called to undertake the business which you have done me the unmerited honor to choose me for. If some regard may be had to my outward comfort, I might mention the many inconveniences and great detriment which may be sustained by my removing with my numerous family so far from all the estate I have in the world, without any prospect of disposing of it under the present circumstances, but with great loss. Now, when we have scarcely got over the trouble and damage sustained by our removal from Northampton, and have just begun to have our affairs in a comfortable situation for a subsistence in this place, and the expense I must immediately be at to put myself into circumstances tolerably comporting with the needful support of the honor of the office I am invited to, which will not well consist with my ability, But this is not my main objection. The chief difficulties in my mind in the way of accepting this important and arduous office are these two. First, my own defects unfitting me for such an undertaking, many of which are generally known besides other, which my own heart is conscious of. I have a constitution in many respects peculiarly unhappy, attended with facade solids, vivid, seasy, and scarce fluids, and a low tide of spirits, often occasioning a kind of childish weakness and contemptibleness of speech, presence, and demeanor, with a disagreeable dullness and stiffness, much unfitting me for conversation, but more especially for the government of a college. This makes me shrink at the thoughts of taking upon me in the decline of life such a new and great business attended with such a multiplicity of cares and requiring such a degree of activity, alertness, and spirit of government, especially in succeeding one so remarkably well qualified in these respects, giving occasion to everyone to remark the wide difference. I am also deficient in some parts of learning, particularly in algebra and the higher parts of mathematics and in the Greek classics, my Greek learning having been chiefly in the New Testament. The other thing is this, that my engaging in this business will not well consist with those views and that course of employ in my study, which have long engaged and swallowed up my mind and been the chief entertainment and delight of my life. And here, honored sirs, emboldened by the testimony I have now received of your unmerited esteem to rely on your candor, I will with freedom open myself to you. The method of study from my first beginning the work of the ministry has been very much by writing, applying myself to this way to improve every important hint, pursuing the clue to my utmost when anything in reading, meditation, or conversation has been suggested to my mind that seemed to promise light in any weighty point, thus pinning what appear to me my best thoughts on innumerable subjects for my own benefit. The longer I prosecuted my studies in this method, the more habitual it became, and the more pleasant and profitable I found it. The further I traveled in this way, the more and wider the field opened, which has occasioned my laying out many things in my mind to do in this manner if God should spare my life, which my heart hath been much upon, particularly many things against most of the prevailing errors of the present day, which I cannot with any patience see maintained to the utter subverting of the gospel of Christ with so high a hand and so long continued a triumph with so little control when it appears so evident to me that there is truly no foundation for any of this glory and insult. I have already published something on one of the main points in dispute between the Arminians and the Calvinists, and here it in view, God willing, as I have already signified to the public, in like manner to consider all the other controverted points and have done much towards preparation for it. But besides these, I have had on my mind and heart, which I long ago began, not with any view to publication, a great work which I call a History of the Work of Redemption, a body of divinity and an entire new method being thrown into the form of a history concerning the affair of Christian theology as the whole of it in each part stands in reference to the great work of redemption by Jesus Christ, which I suppose to be of all others the grand design of God and the summit and ultimate of all the divine operations and decrees, particularly considering all parts of the grand scheme in their historical order, the order of their existence or their being brought forth to review in the course of divine dispensations or the wonderful series of successive acts and events, beginning from eternity and descending from thence to the great work and successive dispensations of the infinitely wise God in time, considering the chief events coming to pass in the Church of God and the revolutions in the world of mankind affecting the state of the Church and the affair of redemption, which we have account of in history or prophecy, till at last we come to the general resurrection, last judgment, and consummation of all things. When it shall be said, it is done. I am the Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end, concluding my work with the consideration of that perfect state of things, which shall be finally settled to the vast for eternity. This history will be carried on with regard to all three worlds, heaven, earth, and hell, considering the connected successive events and alterations in each, so far as the Scriptures give any light, introducing all parts of divinity in that order which is most scriptural and most natural, a method which appears to me the most beautiful and entertaining, wherein every divine doctrine will appear to greatest advantage in the brightest light in the most striking manner, showing the admirable contexture and harmony of the whole. I have also, for my own profit and entertainment, done much towards another great work, which I call the Harmony of the Old and New Testament in three parts. The first, considering the prophecies of the Messiah, his redemption and kingdom, the evidence of their references to the Messiah, etc., comparing them all one with another, demonstrating their agreement, true scope, and sense, also considering all the various particulars wherein these prophecies have their exact fulfillment, showing the universal, precise, and admirable correspondency between the predictions and events. The second part, considering the types of the Old Testament, showing the evidence of their being intended as representations of the great things of the gospel of Christ, and the agreement of the type with the antitype. The third and great part, considering the harmony of the Old and New Testament as to doctrine and precept. In the course of this work, I find there will be occasion for an explanation of a very great part of Holy Scripture, which may, in such a view, be explained in a method which to me seems the most entertaining and profitable, best tending to lead the mind to a view of the true spirit, design, life, and soul of the Scriptures, as well as their proper use and improvement. I have also many other things in hand, in some of which I have made great progress, which I will not trouble you with an account of. Some of these things, if divine providence favor, I should be willing to attempt a publication of. So far as I myself am able to judge of what talents I have for benefiting my fellow creatures by word, I think I can write better than I can speak. My heart is so much in these studies that I cannot feel willing to put myself into an incapacity to pursue them any more in the future part of my life to such a degree as I must, if I undertake to go through the same course of employ in the office of a president that Mr. Burr did, instructing in all the languages and taking the whole care of the instruction of one of the classes in all parts of learning besides his other labors. If I should see light to determine me to accept the place offered me, I should be willing to take upon me the work of the president so far as it consists in the general inspection of the whole society, and to be subservient to the school as to their order and methods of study and instruction, assisting myself in immediate instruction in the arts and sciences, as discretion should direct and occasion serve in the state of things require, especially the senior class, and added to all, should be willing to do the whole work of a professor of divinity in public and private lectures, proposing questions to be answered and some to be discussed in writing and free conversation, in meetings of graduates and others appointed in proper seasons for these ends. It would be now out of my way to spend time in a constant teaching of the languages, unless it be the Hebrew tongue, which I should be willing to improve myself in by instructing others. On the whole, I am much at a loss with respect to the way of duty in this important affair. I am in doubt whether, if I should engage in it, I should not do what both you and I would be sorry for afterwards. Nevertheless, I think the greatness of the affair and the regard due to so worthy and venerable a body as that of the trustees of Nassau Hall requires my taking the matter into serious consideration, and unless you should appear to be discouraged by the things which I have now represented as to any further expectations from me, I shall proceed to ask advice of such as I esteem most wise, friendly, and faithful. If after the mind of the commissioners in Boston is known, it appears that they consent to leave me at liberty with respect to the business they have employed me in here. In this suspense, he determined to ask the advice of a number of gentlemen in the ministry on whose judgment and friendship he could rely and to act accordingly, who upon his and his people's desires met at Stockbridge, January 4th, 1758. And having heard Mr. Edwards' representation of the matter and what his people had to say by way of objection against his removal, determined it was his duty to accept of the invitation of the presidency of the college. When they published their judgment and advice to Mr. Edwards and his people, he appeared uncommonly moved and affected with it, and fell into tears on the occasion, which was very unusual for him in the presence of others, and soon after said to the gentlemen who had given their advice that it was a matter of wonder to him, that they could so easily, as they appeared to do, get over the objections he had made against his removal. But as he thought it his duty to be directed by their advice, he should now endeavor cheerfully to undertake it, believing he was in the way of his duty. Accordingly, having had, by the application of the trustees of the college, the consent of the commissioners to resign their mission, he girded up his loins and set off from Stockbridge for Princeton in January. He left his family at Stockbridge, not to be removed till spring. He had two daughters at Princeton, Mrs. Burr, the widow of the late President Burr, and his oldest daughter that was unmarried. His arrival at Princeton was to the great satisfaction and joy of the college. The corporation met as soon as he could be with convenience after his arrival at the college, when he was by them fixed in the president's chair. While at Princeton, before his sickness, he preached in the college hall Sabbath after Sabbath, to the great acceptance of the hearers, but did nothing as president, unless it was to give out some questions in divinity to the senior class, to be answered before him, each one having opportunity to study and write what he thought proper upon them. When they came together to answer them, they found so much entertainment and profit by it, especially by the light and instruction Mr. Edwards communicated and what he said upon the questions, when they had delivered what they had to say, that they spoke of it with the greatest satisfaction and wonder. During this time, Mr. Edwards seemed to enjoy an uncommon degree of the presence of God. He told his daughters he once had great exercise, concern, and fear relative to his engaging in that business, but since it now appeared, so far as he could see, that he was called of God to that place and work, he did cheerfully devote himself to it, leaving himself and the event with God in order what seemed to him good. The smallpox had now become very common in the country and was then at Princeton and likely to spread. And as Mr. Edwards had never had it, and inoculation was then practiced with great success in those parts, he proposed to be inoculated if the physician should advise to it and the corporation would give their consent. Accordingly, by the advice of the physician and the consent of the corporation, he was inoculated February 13th. He had it favorably, and it was thought all danger was over. But a secondary fever set in, and by reason of a number of pustules in his throat, the obstruction was such that the medicines necessary to check the fever could not be administered. It therefore raged till it put an end to his life on the 22nd of March, 1758, in the 55 years of his age. After he was sensible that he could not survive that sickness a little before his death, he called his daughter to him, who attended him in his sickness, and addressed her in a few words, which were immediately taken down in writing as near as could be recollected, and are as follows. Dear Lucy, it seemed to me to be the will of God that I must shortly leave you. Therefore, give my kindest love to my dear wife, and tell her that the uncommon union which has so long subsisted between us has been of such a nature as I trust is spiritual and therefore will continue forever. And I hope she will be supported under so great a trial and submit cheerfully to the will of God. And as to my children, you are now like to be left fatherless, which I hope will be an inducement to you all to seek a father who will never fail you. And as to my funeral, I would have it to be like Mr. Burr's, and any additional sum of money that might be expected to be laid out that way, I would have it disposed of to charitable uses. Footnote: President Burr ordered on his deathbed that his funeral should not be attended with pomp and cost. Here, that nothing should be expended but what was agreeable to the dictates of Christian decency, and that the sum which must be expended at a modest funeral above the necessary cost of a decent one should be given to the poor out of his estate. End of footnote. He said but very little in his sickness, but was an admirable instance of patience and resignation to the last. Just at the close of life, as some persons who stood by expecting he would breathe his last in a few minutes, were lamenting his death, not only as a great frown on the college, but as having a dark aspect on the interests of religion in general, to their surprise, not imagining that he heard or ever would speak another word, he said, "Trust in God, and ye need not fear." These were his last words. What could have been more suitable to the occasion, and what need of more? In these is in as much matter of instruction and support as if he had written a volume. This is the one consolation of his bereaved friends, who are sensible of the loss they in the Church of Christ had sustained in his death. God is all sufficient and still has the care of his church. He appeared to have the uninterrupted use of his reason to the last and died with as much calmness and composure to all appearances as that with which one goes to sleep. The physician here inoculated and closely attended him in his sickness has the following words in his letter to Mrs. Edwards on this occasion. Never did any mortal man more fully and clearly evidence the sincerity of all his professions by one continued universe, calm, cheerful resignation and patient submission to the divine will, through every stage of his disease than he. Not so much as one discontented expression or the least appearance of murmuring through the whole, and never did any person expire with more perfect freedom from pain. Not so much as one distortion, but in the most proper sense of the words, he really fell asleep. End of chapter 5, having been read by Peter John Parisius.
The Works of the President Jonathan Edwards, Volume 1, dated 1808. Chapter 6, His Publications, Manuscripts, and Genius as a Writer. Mr. Edwards is greatly esteemed, and indeed celebrated as an author both in America and Europe. His publications naturally rise in the reader of judgment and moral taste, a high opinion of his greatness and piety. His books met with a great reception in Scotland especially, and procured for him great esteem and applause. A gentleman on note there has the following words concerning Mr. Edwards in a letter to one of his correspondents in America. I looked at him as incomparably the greatest divine and moral philosopher in Britain or her colonies, and rejoiced that one so eminently qualified for teaching divinity was chosen president of New Jersey College. In another letter, the same gentleman says, ever since I was acquainted with Mr. Edwards' writings, I have looked upon him as the greatest divine this age has produced. And a reverend gentleman from Holland observed that Mr. Edwards' writings, especially on the freedom of the will, were held in great esteem there, and that the professors of the celebrated academy presented their compliments to President Edwards. This gentleman further observes that several members of the classes of Amsterdam gave their thanks by him to pious Mr. Edwards for his just observations on Mr. Brainerd's life, which book was translated in Holland and was highly approved by the University of Utrecht. As these memoirs are introductory to a complete edition of Mr. Edwards' works, a professed enumeration of all his publications must be needless. Yet, as it is not desirable on many accounts to observe a chronological order in their arrangements, a view of these works, which were published by himself and the chief of their posthumous production, according to the order of time, may be accepted to many. For this, the reader is referred to the note below. Note, 1731, a sermon preached at Boston on 1 Corinthians 1, 29 and 30. 1734, D.O. period at Northampton on Matthew 16, verse 17. 1736, a narrative of the work of God, etc. 1738, five discourses at Northampton. 1741, a sermon preached at Enfield. 1741, D.O. period at New Haven on 1 John 4, 1. 1741, D.O. period at Hatfield. 1742, Thoughts on Religion. 1746, Religious Affections. 1747, On Prayer for a Revival. 1749, Ordination Sermon. 1749, Life of Reverend David Brennan. On Qualifications for Communion. 1752, A Reply to S. Period Williams' Answer. A sermon preached at Newark on James 2:19. 1754, On the Freedom of the Will. 1758, On Original Sin. N.B. This last was in the press when the author died. All his other works were collected from papers after his decease, the principal of which were published in the following order. 1765, 18 sermons with his life prefix. 1774, The History of Redemption. 1788, On the Nature of Virtue. 1788, God's Last End in the Creation. 33 sermons. 1789, 20 sermons. 1793, Miscellaneous Observations. 1796, Miscellaneous Remarks. End of the footnote. Viewing Mr. Edwards as a writer of sermons, we cannot give him the epithet eloquence in the common acceptation of the term. We see in him nothing of the great masters of eloquence, except good sense, conclusive reasoning, and the power of moving the passions. Oracle pomp, a cryptic method, a luxurious description presented to the imagination in a rich variety of rhetoric figures, and it nodded to his plan. But his thoughts are well digested and his reasoning conclusive. He produces considerations which not only force the assent, but also touch the conscious. He urges divine authority by quoting and explaining scripture in a form calculated to rouse the soul. He moves the passions. Now, by little artifice, like the professed rhetoric, but by saying what is much to the purpose in a plain, serious, and interesting way, and thus making reason, conscience, fear, and love to be decidedly in his favor. And thus the passions are moved in the most profitable manner. The more generous ones take the lead, and they are ever directed in the way of practical utility. From what has been said, it is easy to conjecture that close discussions were peculiarly suited to Mr. Edwards' talents. And as a further evidence to show which way his genius had its prevailing bent, it is observable that his style improves in proportion to the obtrusiveness of his subject. Hence, generally speaking, the production, especially those published by himself, which either enter into close, profound metaphysic distinctions, seem to have as much perspicacity as the nature of the case will admit. To be convinced of the propriety of this remark, the reader need only consult the Treatise of the Will, a work justly thought to able judges to be one of the greatest efforts of the human intellect. Here the author shows such force and strength of mind, such judgment, penetration, and accuracy of thought, as justly entitles him to the character of one of the greatest geniuses of his age. We may add that this treatise goes further, perhaps, towards settling the main points in controversy between Calvinism and Arminianism, which, than in anything that has been written. Herein, he has abundantly demonstrated the chief principles on which Arminianism built their whole scheme to be false and most absurd. Whenever, therefore, this book comes to be generally attended to, it will doubtlessly prove fatal to Arminian and Pelagian, Pelagian principles. Through the work now mentioned, afforded the fairest opportunity for metaphysical investigation. Yet the same penetrating turn, the same accuracy of discrimination, and the same closeness of reasoning distinguish many of his other productions. Among these, we might mention particularly his book on original sin, his discourse on justification, his dissertation on the nature of true virtue, and that concerning the end for which God created the world. If the advocates of selfish virtue and of universal restoration will do themselves the justice to examine these dissertations with candor and closeness, they may see cause to be of the author's mind. Here other discourses are excellent, including much divinity, intending above most that are published to awaken the conscience of the sinner, as well as to instruct and quicken the Christian. The sermon preached at Edenfield, 8th July 1741, entitled Sinners in the Hand of an Angry God, was intended with remarkable impressions on many of the hearers. In his treatise entitled A Humble Attempt to Promote Explicit Agreement and Visible Union of God's People, An Extraordinary Prayer for the Revival of Religion, he shares great acquaintance with Scripture and a remarkable attention to the prophetic part of it. Mr. Edwards left a great number of volumes and manuscripts, which he wrote in a miscellaneous way on almost all subjects in divinity. This he did not with any design that they should ever be published in that form, but for the satisfaction and improvement of his own mind that he might retain the thoughts which appeared to him worth preserving. Some idea of the progress he had made and the materials he had collected in this way, he gives in his letter to the trustees of the college when assigning his reasons against accepting the presidentship. He had written much of the prophecies concerning the Messiah and justification, the divinity of Christ, and the eternity of hell torments. He wrote much in the Bible in the same way, pinning his thoughts of particular passages as they occurred to him in reading or meditation. As the method he took to have miscellaneous writings in good order, so as to be able with ease to turn to any particular subject, is perhaps as good as any, if not the best, that has been proposed to the public. Some account of it here given for the use of young students who have not yet adopted any method and are disposed to improve their minds by writing. He numbered all his miscellaneous writings. The first thing he wrote is number one, the second, number two, and so on. And when he had occasion to write any particular subject, he first sat down the number and then wrote the subject in large character, that it might not escape his eye when he should have occasion to turn to it. For instance, if he was going to write on the happiness of angels, and his last number was 148, he would begin thus, 149, angels, their happiness. When he wrote what he designed, he returned to his alphabetical table, and under the letter A would write angels, their happiness. So this was not there already, then said the number 149, close at the right hand of it. And if he had occasion to write any new thoughts on the same subject, if the number of his miscellanies were increased, so that his last number was 261, he would set the number 262, and then his subject as before. And when he had done writing for that time, he turned to his table to the word angels. In the right hand of number 149, he set down 262. By this means, he had no occasion to leave any chisel, but began his next subject where he left off his last. The number of his miscellaneous writings ranged in this manner amounts to about 1,400. And yet, by a table contained in a sheet or two of paper, anything he wrote could be turned to at pleasure. A just picture of this eminent servant of God is given in the following expressive lines, taken from the Triumph of Infidelity, an ingenious secretarial poem ascribed to Dr. Dwight, president of Yale College. But my chief bane, my apostle's foe, and life and labor, source of every woe, from scenes obscure did heaven in his Edwards call, that mortal Newton's and the second Paul, he in clear view saw sacred systems roll, of reasoning worlds around their central soul, saw love attractive, every system bind, the patient linking to every fidel mind. The end of heaven's high works resistless serve, creating glory, created good, and in one little life the glory, the gospel more, disclosed with all earthly merits cleanly kindled before. Beneath his standard, lo, what numbers rise, to care for truth and combat for the skies. Armed at all points, they try the battlefield, with reasoning sword and face in rational shield. The inscription upon the stone, which is over the grave of Mr. Edwards in Princeton, composed originally by President Finley, has been very obligingly sent on by a particular friend, and here is gratefully inscribed as the close of the memoirs. M.S. Jonathan Edwards, A.M. The rest of it's all in Latin. End of chapter 6. Remember Peter John Priest's.